Welcome back, Clinical Problem Solvers. This episode is sponsored by Freed, an AI scribe that does your medical documentation for you instantly. The story behind this is the love story. Gabby, a family medicine physician, is married to Erez, who's a computer engineer. And we've all been there. Gabby was spending significant hours at night completing her charting, and Erez wanted to spend time with his wife. So in order to do that, and with the skill set that he had, he created Freed. And this is such a phenomenal product. I used it. It literally captures the encounter and generates a note. Think as if you had an invisible scribe sitting right next to you, except it's artificial intelligence. We're in a really cool era right now. So this Freed listens, prepares your notes, and writes patient instructions. And the charting is done as soon as the patient leaves the room. It is HIPAA compliant, and it takes less than 30 seconds to learn. Make sure to try the free version, meaning you can do 10 free encounters before you have to subscribe. I promise you, this is a game changer. And don't forget, when you do subscribe, use Clinical50, code Clinical50 for $50 off your first month.
Is it Reza loves Robbie or Robbie loves Reza? It's the best palindrome, you will be so impressed. Oh, it's the mathematician and the magician laying out the art of deduction. It's RLR.
Welcome back, Clinical Problem Solver.
Woo. Aaron, that was really good.
I'm working on it.
We're going to jump right into the case. And for this case, I'm going to need both a neurologist and an internist. And I'm going to present this case in a way that's going to lend itself most to learning as opposed to actual clinical care. And I'm going to have you guys sort of construct the story after I give you the pivot point. So I'm going to have you guys recreate the story as to what the HPI should have been. But I'll just say this much. A patient who's in his 70s gets a head CT. The head CT shows a hypoattenuation in the left frontal lobe, which prompts an MRI. And I'm about to share with you the MRI, Aaron. And I'd love for you to tell me what slices you want to see, what you find, and then share your framework there. One second. Okay. You guys can see the MRI? Yes, you can. Aaron, why don't you tell me which, specific sequence you want me to start with?
Yeah, thanks. So usually I'll start with an axial flare, which you have there, number 5, the next one down. Yeah, perfect. And the flare will show us any signal abnormalities. Yeah, if you put it there and double click, you should get perfect. Any signal abnormalities of any type, and we'll get a look at the structure also. So nothing so far. So I'm waiting to see what's going on in the left frontal lobe where you had seen something on the CT. Yeah. Okay. So yeah, I think if you just use the arrows left and right, prof res, then yeah, perfect. It'll be a little smoother. Okay. So I see this thing in the left frontal lobe. Yeah. So what is, and then when there's a lesion, I always like to sort of pause my thinking and say, let me just look at the rest of the scan now, make sure I didn't miss anything because my eye focused on some big lesion. All that I saw kind of coming up and down was just some scattered microvascular disease. And that's the main lesion. And that thing that, if you just don't mind going a little slower around there, thing that is jumping out to me here is that the lesion appears to follow the, or sort of respect the gray-white junction. And if there was a stroke this close to the cortex, I think we've talked about this before on CT, usually involve the cortex and the underlying white matter. And as far as I can tell here, it looks like it comes up to the gray-white junction and just stops. So when you told me 70-year-old, new hypodensity, I thought probably it's going to be a stroke, but now I'm thinking differently. So probably given that, the next thing I would look at would be a T1 post-contrast scan, which is probably at the bottom, to see if that's a T1 pre, probably. Usually it's the very last. Yeah, T1 axial post to see what's going on in there. And already we can see it looks like a little very tiny ring of enhancement. And let's just see if there's anything else anywhere else. Okay, so now my suspicion that that's probably not a stroke is confirmed, because on the T1, I can see the hypo intensity going to the gray-white junction and just stopping. You can get enhancement in a subacute stroke. Sometimes this is a source of confusion where people say, oh, could that be a tumor, or could that be an abscess, and it's actually, or, you know, some type of inflammatory process, and it's actually a subacute stroke. But if you had a stroke in this location, probably the patient would know about it, though we don't know the history. There's a very tiny ring, a partial ring, kind of nodule in there. Okay, so now I don't know what that is and would want to know more information about that thing. So I'd want to know on GRE, are there blood products there, number 6 up top? And I'd want to know if there's, so there is, either blood product or calcium. We can't tell which is which on the sequence. Usually these are blood products, but this is one of the rare instances where I'd look at the MRI and say, actually, go back, show me the CT if there's calcium there. But the last thing while we're still here on the MR is there any diffusion restriction there? So probably the first sequence at the top, yeah, DWI trace. The first sequence you see is actually not DWI. I don't know why the scanners do this. Keep going, keep going, keep going. And then the DWI will be after this usually. Yep, that's it. Yep. And is there any diffusion restriction there? Let's see. The opposite. So if it was diffusion restricting, it would be bright there, and it's actually dark. So now actually I may have fallen into a trap of my own. As I said, there was enhancement there, but you can't tell if something's enhancing unless you look at the T1 pre. And if it's bright on the T1 pre, which actually stopped you from showing me to my own peril, so number 7 there, if it's bright also on this, then it's actually not enhancing. It's just T1, intrinsically T1 bright. And I'll tell you why I thought of that. No, it's not. Okay. So there is enhancement and what looks like some blood product there. Okay. And you scrolled a lot through there. I don't know if you're trying to trick me or just there's nothing else to see on the rest. Is that the only thing, Rafraz? Okay. So what I see is a very tiny ring-enhancing lesion at the gray-white junction with blood products and surrounding edema and no other significant findings. So what would I think this would be? 70-year-old person, I would wonder if it's a metastasis and it has some hemorrhage in it. So it could be a melanoma they like to bleed. Could be metastasis from renal cell cancer, choriocarcinoma, obviously not in a 70-year-old. And thyroid cancer are thought to be the brain metastases more likely to bleed, although I think we've talked about this before. Statistically, lung cancer to the brain is so common, even though there's a low probability of hemorrhage, it's still one of the most common hemorrhagic metastases just because the denominator is so high. But the mnemonic we use for metastases very likely to bleed is MRCT, just like MRI and CAT scan, which is melanoma, renal cell carcinoma, choriocarcinoma, and thyroid. Have I ever seen thyroid go to the brain? Never. Renal cell, rarely. Choreo, one case ever for me, and then melanoma all the time, right? So I would wonder if this is a metastasis, if there's no history of cancer, and then where his workup for cancer is clean, is that a small infectious lesion? If that is not a if that is not blood and actually calcium, which you can get confused on susceptibility, could be a small neurocysticercosis lesion, for example. It could be a toxo lesion, an abscess. The lesion is so small and right at the gray-white junction. My best guess radiologically would be a metastasis. And then how do I think the patient presented? I would wonder if he presented with a seizure, and that's what brought him to medical attention. That's the best I can do, reverse engineering the case from the end. But this is the real reality of life when the neurologist probably would have been called, right? Is, hey, we got this guy here with some abnormal imaging. And we might have said, yo, what's going on? And said, well, we were told to consult you, or I just got signed out. I haven't seen him. I just told to consult you for the MRI finding. So that's what I'd be thinking based on the imaging alone.
Well, that was awesome. I'm going to read you the official read of the MRI, and then I'm going to ask Robbie to ask any follow-up questions with regard to your analysis so far. So everything you said, the radiologist said, except for one thing, they say there's an area of expansile white matter edema that lies within the posterior medial left frontal lobe. They say this is a vasogenic edema without evidence of diffusion restriction. The post-contrast T1 shows a 6-millimeter enhancing focus seen co-located in the area of the white matter edema and this enhancing focus in the gray-white junction. But the thing they don't mention is any hemorrhage. And you'll see this will be important when I share further story. But they say that they don't comment on hemorrhage, but they don't say there's any hemorrhage whatsoever, just vasogenic edema.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I should mention, I forget if I...
Do you buy that or do you think they made a mistake?
Well,
if they made a mistake, then I'm in trouble, but hopefully they didn't make a mistake.
Don't incriminate anyone. Always give people the benefit of the doubt. At least what I could see is the susceptibility weighted imaging. What's dark on there is either blood or calcium. And so unless there was a calcification on CT in that spot, that would be considered blood products, I would think. But maybe there's some other radiologic explanation that I'm not thinking of. And... What was the only other thing I was going to mention is that location. So it was a very tiny ring, since people won't be able to see this, not a big, thick abscess toxo looking ring, but it's also a very tiny ring right at the gray-white junction. And that is a place that metastases tend to find their way to. I think just high blood flow, sort of end arterial territory, small metastatic foci. What would be peculiar is one single tiny met. Usually there is more than one at presentation, but at least radiologically, not knowing any context, my best guess would be a small hemorrhagic met.
It was really incredible to see you, Aaron, not take the word lesion, which is probably all that I could really say with confidence, and actually dissect it based on its location, its consequences of edema and possible hemorrhage. It was really kind of surreal. I'll say one thing that struck me was the sheer amount of edema relative to the size of this thing. I was shocked when you articulated that the edema, at least it looked to me that the edema is almost tenfold in visual size to a novice than the actual lesion. And I'm curious if that data point gives you juice in any sort of diagnostic way.
Yeah, great point that I should have commented on. It's always one challenge when you do this on the fly and you're looking at things in a particular order, especially with no context, right? But you saw the edema first. I'm thinking, what's in there? And then I got excited about the ring. But you make a good point. It's a very tiny ring with a lot of edema around it. What to do with that? Yeah, it's meaningful, but I'm not sure yet what the meaning is. It's true that these tiny micro metastases, sometimes you hardly see anything on flare and you just see that small ring enhancing foci that they probably shouldn't generate as much edema. It'd be a little weird to get just one, but not impossible. So, you know, always good to go back to our, you know, just first principles. What's the differential diagnosis for a ring enhancing lesion? We mentioned infections, like toxo, abscess. And toxo is one where sometimes the edema is huge, mass effect, and then there's just a tiny little ring in the middle. But I'm not sure it tells us anything specific, but I agree it's worth flagging and keeping note of. So yeah, what would be our approach to this ring enhancing lesion? Again, we'd want to know how the patient presented, if he has a known history of cancer, immunocompromised, or otherwise that would steer us in a direction. If he's coming fresh and has no medical history or no known, we'd want to get an HIV test. That would be a big bifurcation here, because if he's HIV positive, then we'd want to get a CD4 count, which would be another bifurcation, what the patient could be at risk for. If those are all negative, it's a tiny lesion there, I'd probably be curious about a CT chest, abdomen, pelvis to look for cancer. And then I said it doesn't really look like a stroke, and I stand by that, although not impossible to have a small stroke with hemorrhagic conversion there and edema around it. Didn't really look like that to me, but if we come up totally dry, he's HIV negative, not immunocompromised, no signs of systemic cancer, then you have to ask yourself, what else could that be? Again, we'll hear how he presented. If he presented with acute onset aphasia, it could be ictal aphasia seizing from whatever this lesion is, or one would have to wonder, yeah, if that could be a stroke. But at least from what I could see, again, always hard to see, like sort of the delay of scrolling on Zoom, it looked like gray-white was respected and less likely to be stroke. But just so you know, stroke, if it's subacute, in other words, the syndrome is always acute, but if it's a stroke that was unrecognized or takes time to get the scan, days to weeks out, you can get a little gyriform enhancement and people can get very confused by that. But so, yeah, I think the flare pattern didn't really look stroke-like to me. But those would definitely be other things to think about in this context.
Aaron, quick question for you. Sometimes I think it's super helpful to know what's in our diagnostic toolkit when we're approaching any kind of abnormality. When you see a brain mass, a brain lesion, what is in your diagnostic armamentarium? Of course, like, from EEG to LP to ultimately a brain biopsy. But if you can just speak, like, what tools do we have And how frequently do you actually land in the world of biopsying the lesion in the brain?
Yeah, great question. So yeah, I mean, I think most neurology patients with something localizing to the brain are going to get an MRI, right? And most of the time, MRI is going to be pretty good on getting us pretty close to the answer, just because common things being common, we see a lot of stroke, and usually there's no mystery around that. If it's a fully parenchymal lesion, like in this case, and we can't really tease it apart on imaging, which I would say, you know, at least devoid of history at this point, not sure that we can. This is one where I think CT chest, abdomen, pelvis, I would probably do next rather than LP. I found, you know, coming from Boston to San Francisco, that I've observed people tend to get a lot more lumbar punctures here than at least felt like the prevailing practice in Boston, or maybe it's me. And, you know, if it's a parenchymal lesion, the yield is going to probably be relatively low if it's not a process actually affecting the meninges or in the CSF space. But you could imagine a situation where this patient is HIV negative, CT chest, abdomen, pelvis negative. We say, look, it doesn't look like it's anything we can diagnose by systemic circumstances and arrows pointing from systemic to the brain. People would start saying, well, what's next? Should we get CSF? And I guess you sort of say, I mean, I guess, but I'm not sure it's going to show us much. Maybe some nonspecific inflammation. And I'd probably say, gee, you know, depending on what the history is here, not immunocompromised, you don't find a cancer CT chest, abdomen, pelvis, I'd say, it's a hemorrhagic looking thing. How about a detailed skin exam? Is there a melanoma on the back, on the foot, somewhere we can't see it? Is it worth getting a PET scan and making sure we're not missing some small thing? If we sort of get to a point where we say, look, we don't know what this is, if the patient looks fine, you could say, they look fine. We didn't find anything else. They're not immunocompromised. They don't look like they have a systemic cancer. We could image it again in 2 weeks. If you sort of call neurosurgery and say, we'd like to biopsy this thing, a lot of times they will say appropriately, can you get CSF first? Because if you make the diagnosis that way, you save the patient the brain biopsy. But you know, CSF cytology, pretty low yield unless, you know, the patient has leptomeningeal metastases, diagnosing lymphoma, which doesn't really look like by CSF. People say you need 3 LPs before you get adequate sensitivities to exclude it. And I think, you know, even with 3 LPs, sometimes we've missed it and the biopsy shows lymphoma. So, yeah.
Thank you so much, Aaron. Robbie, this is where I want to involve you now to help guide the discussion even more. And again, we're going to reconstruct this story, but this individual gets this PET CT, and I just want to raise your attention to a few things. One is this huge mass in the left kidney. You can see it right there, Robbie, and we'll include pictures online. The other thing I wanted to sort of focus your attention to is the lung field. You see this pleural effusion. There is some FDG avidity there in the pleural effusion. And then now we're going to look at the lung parenchyma. And what you'll see in the lung parenchyma is a few cavitary lesions. So cavitary lesions, one sort of solid nodule that's FDG avid, significant right pleural effusion greater than left. And this huge mass on the left kidney right there that's really FDG avid. And you can see, I think, an atrophic right kidney. So Robbie, what I'd like you to do is like incorporate this into your thinking. And then I'll give you guys some actual data as you're reconstructing this story.
Yeah, Professor, anytime that we're trying to understand a syndrome and we're essentially trying to connect the dots, it's helpful first to summarize what the dots are. And the dots are, you know what I'm going to say next, I think, based on your smile. We have a brain mass, we have a kidney mass, and then we have, let's just call it lung stuff and pleural stuff. And you're trying to synthesize them all together. I think the first thing you have to realize that if you're trying to put them all together, you're making an assumption that they are in fact correlated, they are linked. It is very, very possible that you have an incidental lesion that pops out of the calculus and you only have to connect 3 things or 2 things or 1 thing. And I think that's especially important with the kidney mass. So a kidney mass, I would say, is most helpful to begin your thinking for 2 reasons. The first is metastatic disease to the kidney is exceedingly rare. So if the kidney is involved in this complex calculus of 4 things, it has to be the origin of something. It cannot be the destination. But the other reason it's helpful is because many, many patients with renal cell carcinoma have low-grade incidental renal cell carcinoma. And so it is totally plausible that this thing is just sitting there and is actually not part of the quadrant that we're trying to connect, which turns back into three things. So that's how I would definitively tell you what the kidney is. It's either the cause or it's completely unrelated. And what does the lung stuff do for us? I think the lung stuff reminds us what Aaron started with is we're leaning towards cancer because of the age of the patient, the lack of overt infectious symptoms we've heard about so far. But whenever you get cavitation, you have to slow down. You have to slow down because you can easily pin cavitary lesions to cancer, especially squamous cell carcinoma of the lung, or even metastatic diseases to the lung. But this makes you have a diagnostic pause and do a checklist for the atypical infections that cause cavitary lesions. The pleura in this context is very likely the opposite of the kidney. It's unlikely to be the primary source of this process and very, very likely to be a metastatic either cancer or infection. That's because the primary pleural tumor, mesothelioma, would not behave in this manner and causes local extension. So I think here's what we conclude for sure. The brain is the site of consequence, not the cause. The kidney is the site of cause, not consequence. The pleura is the site of consequence, not cause. And the lungs are the hardest to analyze. They're often the origin of devastation in older adults. But because of their vascular nature and the way they're fed by a pulmonary artery, i.e. the whole blood supply, they're frequently a consequence as well. So that's all I can say for sure. It's a tricky one to try to put together and synthesize.
Can I ask you, Robbie, I love the cause versus the consequence. How would you go, what would you do next for this? Like, how would you work this up?
Yeah, you know, that's the, you know what Aaron did for the MRI? I would have said brain lesion, and he turned that into like so much juice. I think the first step in real life is radiology, radiology, radiology. What does this renal mass look like on CT scan? Because the CT scan characteristics of the renal mass can be diagnostic of RCC. So that's probably the first step I would do. Another very easy step is we all agree that the yield of the CSF is low here, but the yield of the pleural fluid may be through the roof here, because you might find TB or you might find carcinoma. So my first two steps would be to do those things. But I think we've all been humbled about trying to proceed in a case by moving forward. In this case, we probably should move backwards and understand the HPI, the medical history, the fans, and stuff like that. Those would be the low-hanging fruit that I would do.
I will say, go ahead. Sorry, Risen.
No, please, Aaron.
Yeah, no, that's brilliant to hear you. Yeah, the radiology, I just saw there was a lot of stuff lighting up and the lungs looked abnormal. So it's fun on the other side to see you both analyze the radiology and then try to tell the story from it. You know, we both sort of said cancer, 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 but there could be infection here. And I presented both of you probably a year or two ago a case where we all thought it was cancer. There were plenty of masses to biopsy, plenty of lesions that ended up being TB. And so when I heard cavitary lung lesion, I had a big pause also of, you know, could that brain lesion be a tuberculoma? Because I got burned. And you might say, but a tuberculoma shouldn't bleed. And one humbling lesson we learned in that case is there's a study, I think, out of India, where they're trying to distinguish tuberculoma from glioma. And a lot of the tuberculomas in that study apparently had a little ring of susceptibility. And one of the things that led us astray in our patient was that she had these tiny ring-enhancing lesions at the gray-white junction, older patient, as you both might remember, set up for cancer, had a pelvic mass, breast mass, lymphadenopathy, no TB exposures, and radiologically had blood products in the lesions that led us away from TB. But I will retain my quote-unquote recency bias for that case forever, because it was very humbling to miss TB. So, you know, if there hadn't been any of that lung stuff and the patient has no risk factors for TB, I would probably stick with metastasis, but I just want to keep tuberculosis in play. And then also learning from that case, patient can have a lot of different things going on, as you said. Robbie, there may be one or more of these things may be incidental. The brain is obviously not. The pleural fluid is obviously not. A lung nodule, a renal mass, even if malignant, as you said, could be. So it's going to be interesting to see how all of these things fit together and which ones are just red herrings. But yeah, I think TB is on the table. And then when you hear that, you say, oh, you sure? You don't want that lumbar puncture? Well, as you said, we would say, hey, look at all that fluid in the lung. Let's see what that is. Look at that lung and renal mass. Let's see what those are. Although in the case I told you about, when everything came up empty, we were late to the diagnosis of TB. But that was in a case of a pelvic mass. Oops, that can be a fibroid, breast mass. Oops, fibroid pneuma. I don't think you can get away with a huge hot lung lesion. We didn't have PET where I was practicing for that case either. Huge hot lung lesion and a huge hot kidney lesion and say, we can imagine a situation where medicine would say, why don't you do a lumbar puncture first, Ronnie? Yeah.
Fantastic. So now I'm going to just recreate the entire story and share with you the dilemma that I was in, and then just give the mic to the two of you to discuss it. This patient has known renal cell carcinoma, was placed on a tyrosine kinase inhibitor, and was showing really good response to that with controlled disease. By the way, he has known metastatic renal cell carcinoma, but he developed some swelling in his leg. He has nephrotic range proteinuria, and the nephrologists say, you know, it's uncommon, but this can be a consequence of the tyrosine kinase inhibitor. And he did not have nephrotic range proteinuria before this medication was initiated. So they recommend holding the tyrosine kinase inhibitor. This is about 2 months before he presents to us. So while they're holding the tyrosine kinase inhibitor, this new study just shows much worsening metastatic renal cell carcinoma in terms of what's happening in the kidneys and some of the local lymph nodes. But the cavitary lung lesion, this was identified about 6 months prior when he had some shortness of breath. ID was consulted. He did have pleural effusion at that time. They did do a thoracentesis, which showed an exudative effusion. Cytology was negative for malignancy, but ID said that they don't think the pleural effusion is due to an infection. They recommended a BAL with lavage, which showed Mycobacterium avium complex MAC and Aspergillus. So this patient was empirically started on treatment for both MAC and Aspergillus. And this PET CT that I showed you, in fact, shows improvement in the cavitary lung lesions compared to before he was initiated on treatment. So to summarize, and oh, by the way, his entire presentation was his neighbor saw that he was confused. He never lost consciousness, never had, you know, a transient loss of consciousness, and brought him to the emergency department because of this confusion. We don't know what caused the confusion. The next day when I met him, he was totally clear and he could recall, like, hey, I was just feeling weak. They brought me here. My right side feels weaker than the left side. Right side feels weaker than the left side. So to summarize, I have a patient with known renal cell carcinoma with metastasis who recently stopped his therapy, who's presenting with a new brain lesion, and is also being treated for both Aspergillus and MAC. And I had to contend with a few questions. One, can I put him on anticoagulation? By the way, he actually was diagnosed with a PE 6 months prior and was on apixaban. So one question was, can I continue the anticoagulation despite this brain lesion? And then another question was, do I need to pursue any additional biopsy before saying this brain lesion is due to his renal cell carcinoma? And that's sort of do I need to start dexamethasone or anti-epileptics? And I know we briefly talked about this, but I'd love to give the mic to you guys, but that's really what I was contending with. One, let's say if he didn't have a PE, could he be safely put on DVT prophylaxis, pharmacological DVT prophylaxis, because he has cancer? But we know he did have a PE. Can I continue the anticoagulation? Does he need any additional biopsy, or should we just resume his CKI and say this is all metastatic renal cell carcinoma? I'm going to stop talking there and then give the mic to the both of you.
Aaron, I'll just jump here for the sake of time and for the acknowledgement that I have absolutely no idea what I would really do in this circumstance. I'll just pass the mic to you to reflect and then to Reza, because I want to respect Reza's time. I will learn.
Oh man, I was hoping you'd answer some of those questions first. Let's do the easy ones. Can you give DVT prophylaxis to a patient with a brain tumor? Sure. Even if it's hemorrhagic, sure. DVT prophylaxis, no risk. We even give DVT prophylaxis to a patient with an intracerebral hemorrhage, a primary one, after 24 to 48 hours. So usually the hematoma, even in that case, you know, there's a hematoma in the brain and we're okay with that. Presumably the bleeding has stopped. Anticoagulation, Reza and I have talked about a few of these, right? It's always weighing the scales of justice or comparing the poker hands, right? You have to ask, what's the risk of a hemorrhagic complication in the brain compared to the risk of a thrombotic complication if you don't anticoagulate? In this case, I'm guessing the PE would have the winning hand. There's a very tiny focus of blood in a very tiny lesion. Even if that thing really got bled more, it's such a tiny, presumably the hemorrhagic part is that tiny ring-enhancing focus. So if you told me there's kind of an upper extremity DVT, maybe an ultrasound soft call, we kind of wanted to anticoagulate, or hey, it's not really an NSTEMI, but just to be safe, you know, we might say, well, I mean, there is a little blood in the brain. But if you say, hey, we have a PE, we have an NSTEMI, we need to do this antithrombotic therapy, there's very little where neurology would stand in front of the train unless there's like an unsecured aneurysmal hemorrhage or something like that. I think those are where I would start. And then, yeah, what is that thing? Is that metastatic renal cell carcinoma? Before you told me about the MAC and the aspergillus, probably he went off his treatment. He has a new hemorrhagic lesion that looks radiologically like a MET. I think that would be reasonable to get him back on whatever therapy the oncologist think is okay and rescan that and make sure there's not new ones or it's maybe regressing. I have never seen MAC in the brain. I would presume if it goes there, it's going to be some type of abscess, and I wouldn't think it would be hemorrhagic. Aspergillus, on the other hand, like Mucor, can be angioinvasive and can cause stroke or hemorrhage. One dot of hemorrhage, and you said the radiologist didn't even call it. Probably it's a MET, and probably what I would do is you're already treating the infections, and you're probably going to start treating the lung, renal cell again. And so probably I would hang tight and reimage in a couple weeks or a month. And then what else did you ask? Steroids and seizure medicines. Gee, he was confused and then became unconfused with no treatment. Probably had a seizure and was postictal, right? Not too many things that do that. And he has a reason for that. And this could have been a non-convulsive seizure. Maybe he seized, collapsed, nobody saw it. He got up, doesn't remember, and it's just a little postictal. But that location is near Broca's ear. You could seize and have an ictal aphasia or a postictal aphasia when that lesion is in sort of its refractory state, or that region is in its refractory state. So I would say probably he had a seizure. That lesion by itself probably shouldn't make him confused because it was there 3 days ago and he was not confused as far as we know. So probably he bought himself a seizure medicine, and probably I wouldn't even get an EEG. It wouldn't change my management either way, unless he's really fluctuating. And then you'd say, oh, is he having non-convulsive seizures continuously? And then steroids. Well, there is a fair amount of edema around the lesion. If you find that he's weak contralaterally or he's a little confused, I think it's reasonable to give him a short course and clean that up. Unless you told me we would rather not do that in someone with active fungal and mycobacterial infections, and we'd say, okay, probably not a big deal, not that much edema, not much mass effect. Or we said, gee, we really want to have a clean answer in a month when we rescan him, or 2 weeks, to make sure that if we restart his oncologic therapies and that lesion is regressing, that we're treating the right thing. And steroids will clean up his scan a lot. The edema will go away. You close the blood-brain barrier, so he might not even have enhancement and he might get confused. So if he's really weak, disabled on that right side, you might consider it. But to be honest, it's not that much edema. If he's not really that weak and not that worried about it, the cleanest answer you would get radiologically from the brain perspective for this whole thing is if he goes back on his chemo and in a couple of weeks you rescan him and it looks better, you're probably treating the right thing. Whereas the steroids could muddy that picture. So I would say yes, seizure medicine, okay, anticoagulation, and no steroids unless major disability.
That's great. Rob, any questions before I summarize?
Oh, no, I would just introduce the notion how tricky this might be, because if you give quote unquote chemo, it's probably maybe super specific for RCC and may cause other cancers to melt away. So I'm holding on to that angst too. The idea that he maybe has a lung cancer and that you give it not specific treatment that may accidentally treat the lung cancer. So just acknowledging the layers and layers of complexity.
I love that point. And like something that Aaron said, which would have been useful for us on Friday's DMR, is like the idea of rescanning. Like, I don't think of that concept. Like, you know how we get labs and we follow the troponin? It's just not ingrained in my brain to just like repeat image. Like, start a treatment, repeat image. Is it better? Is it worse? And that can guide your clinical reasoning. What we ultimately did for this patient was we did do anticoagulation. Initially, I did Lovenox. And the reason I did Lovenox was because I didn't have the PET CT and I wasn't sure if I needed to do another biopsy. So I didn't want to continue his apixaban. But once I got the PET CT, I was like, well, the cavitary lung lesions are improving. Then oncologists feel pretty comfortable calling this metastatic renal cell carcinoma. So I don't really need to go after any additional tissue. And I put him back on his apixaban. We started him on dexamethasone for the reasons that Aaron mentioned. And he subjectively felt like his right side got better within a day being put on this dexamethasone. And then we got Radonc involved per neurosurgery's recommendation. They actually in-house started radiation therapy. He got 3 days of radiation therapy, and they wanted him to continue the dexamethasone because of the swelling that might be associated with the radiation therapy. For the anti-seizure medication, I think, you know, Aaron, now think hearing you discuss, I would have advocated for them, but we just didn't put as much thought as you did. But I think you're spot on, because that would actually explain his presentation. But hopefully the dexamethasone will be enough to decrease the swelling and prevent any future seizures. So he was put on anti-epileptics for like 48 hours. Then they were discontinued. But I just followed neurosurgery's recommendations there. So he ultimately got discharged with dexamethasone, his apixaban, and his tyrosine kinase inhibitor for his renal cell carcinoma. He got 3 doses of radiation therapy, and he's going to follow up with oncology. Because the other thing is, once you have renal cell in the brain, like, the prognosis could be less than 6 months. And so it's going to be really important to get palliative care involved, you know, to be there to guide him. So that was the case. It was a bit tricky. I had a little bit of angst, and I really appreciate, like, just based on the imaging alone and where the lesion was, you were most concerned for mets, and you were most concerned for one with like a hemorrhagic component. And despite lung cancer being the most common cancer that metastasizes to the brain because it's the most frequent, you still were worried more for one that had more of a bleeding component. So maybe the radiologist overlooked what you had seen on the imaging. That being said, I want to give the mic to you guys to sign us out. And it was just awesome to see the two of you dance together and reconstruct a story from the pivot point.
Prabhupada, I love how he's pointing to me when he looked at that. He's like, hey, this is a med. I think it's RCC because it's bleeding. And now he's pointing to me to reflect, no, Mike is yours, my friend. What are you thinking?
Come on, there was so much medicine there. Well, I think, you know, this is the power of modern neuroradiology. We have all these sequences. You know, on the CT, this was just a hypodensity. Probably that blood product was not enough to even say anything. Maybe you could have said, that's not, it's going up to the gray-white junction. It's not a stroke. And that would be it. And with the MRR, we can say there is edema. There is a ring-enhancing lesion. It has blood products in it. It is not diffusion-restricting, and it respects the gray-white junction. The list of things gets pretty small, and then we can bring that to the table with you guys saying, all right, here's what could be going to the brain. Kidney cancer, lung cancer, MAC, aspergillus. Does this line up with any of those? And we and the neuroradiologist can try to.
Aaron, sorry to interject, but can I just show you the CT really quickly? Because you said, look, if there's no calcification, it even makes you more concerned that there's blood product. Can I just show it so you can close that loop with the audience?
Sure, sure.
Because we, yeah.
Yeah, so this is a nice thing to, you know, teaching point for CT. I think we've talked about this before. A hyperdensity on CT is blood or calcium. When it's bright, you can sometimes get hyperdense, hypercellular tumors that are a little brighter, but not bright, bright. But a hypodensity is everything else, right? It's stroke, abscess, tumor, demyelination, can be anything. And here, what's really key is that this is right next to the cortex, but goes right up to the cortex and stops. It respects the gray-white junction. So all that tells you is that this is not an ischemic stroke. So thereby, it is tumor, it is infection, or it is inflammation. We can't say more based on the CT. And yes, there's no calcium and no blood there. So that tells you that that susceptibility spot is blood products, which maybe help the radiation oncologists and others feel relatively confident that, you know, if we have to tag this with one of the systemic processes, maybe it's the renal cell. Although, as you said, anything that goes to the brain can bleed, and lung cancer commonly goes to the brain and it can bleed, and the denominator is high. So we see it not infrequently, but yeah, it's, if there had been no primary here off the top of one's head, you'd say common things are common, and or melanoma, renal cell, those are the common ones that bleed. So yeah, and I want to just highlight the point that you highlighted also of repeat imaging, right? We're always so eager to try to sort it out in the inpatient setting, particularly sometimes that sort of bleeds over into the outpatient setting. We're like, oh man, I don't know what this is. And I remember one of my mentors saying, just, it's not going to kill the patient right now. And it's not sudden onset. Patient walked in and, you know, see how they're doing in a few weeks. Use time as a diagnostic tool. And for us also, use another neuroimaging test to say, wow, now there's 4 of these things. Gee, you know, that suggests X. Or, hey, now that one thing is getting bigger off of all these treatments, or this is getting smaller on this treatment. So that second imaging point can give some DOS to connect.
Oh,
that's a wrap, folks.
Clinical problem solvers. Are you tired of not getting publications and promoted? We can't help you with that. But if you want to listen to these types of episodes ad-free, subscribe to rlrcpsolvers.com. That is RR's child. It is all our work. We guarantee that you won't regret a subscription. And there's teaching videos, teaching figures, and reflection on most of our episodes.